been a little while now. How many years have you been here? 10? At least 10. Yeah, it's been a while. Sorry to see it go. What kind of times we've been down here? It's been the place we've come to. Well, start off, I can't help but comment. What a lovely, lovely job the ladies did. Some of the best harmony I've ever heard in a church service. I don't know if you gals are related, but oftentimes they say the best harmonies come out of relatives. There's a natural resonance that is produced, and that was spectacular. Matter of fact, if you're looking for an agent and you're going to go on and take this on the road, I'd be glad to step in. Maybe you could call yourselves the Statler Sisters or, you know, Girls United or something, you know. Anyway, lovely job. Very, very pretty. What is in there? Something about help you be the best you could be. It sounds like something, it could be a new kind of a slogan for God's army, right? Isn't that something about the best you can be? Anyway, what a lovely job. Just couldn't help but notice in the bulletin, I don't think I've ever seen this before. I see we have a sermonette, Mr. Dave Hoffert there. But I see that I'm going to be giving a split sermon. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I think what it means, if you don't like the sermon, means you can split. Matter of fact, if I don't like the sermon, I may split before you do. So, anyway. Now I got a reason to mess up. Well, a lot going on at this time of the year. It's good to see old friends again, and like I say, it's going to be kind of sad. Next time we'll meet, we'll be in a new hall, but it doesn't change the people or the ambiance or anything that really is important to church services or Sabbath services, that's for sure. By the way, I'd like to say, Dave Hofford, could you loan me a few of your Orioles? We got a bunch of orange slices hanging out in one of our feeders, and they're looking very sad and getting very dry. We just can't draw Orioles. So whatever you're doing, you know, I'd be glad to have a tip or two, you know, how we can get them in. We just can't get Orioles for some reason. Maybe it's because I don't like the Baltimore baseball team. Maybe, I don't know, something like that. Well, it's graduation time. Have they started graduating here in the metro yet? When is it, next week or something? I know back out in Litchfield, I think it's next week, but starting to graduate. Here's kind of a classic approach to that favorite graduation activity, the graduation speech. When my son graduated from high school, he had to give a speech. He might have been salutatorian or valedictorian or something, although anymore they don't do that so much. That used to be the bailiwick for those with the top grades. He began by reading from his prepared text. I want to talk about my mother and the wonderful influence she has had on my life. He told the audience, she is a shining example of parenthood, and I love her more than words could ever do justice. At this point, he seemed to struggle with his words. After a pause, he looked up with a grin and said, it's really hard to read my mom's handwriting. Sounds like something Lena would do for little Ollie. Anyway. Well, with the big tiff recently between the Israelis and the U.S., and of course, I don't know how many here followed with bated breath, Mr. Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, to me, the finest leader on the planet right now. I really enjoy listening to him. He's got a death grip on reality. And the man, in his second language, he was, I think, educated partially here in the United States, but speaks very, very eloquently, and one of my favorites. So anyway, with all this going on recently, I don't know if this happened, but if it didn't, it should have. And what it is a comment by the Israeli UN representative. It goes like this. A representative from Israel began, before beginning my talk, I want to tell you something about Moses. When he struck, remember this before the UN, A lot of funny things have been going on before the UN recently. Guys like Ahmadinejad, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad stood up and talked about the 12th Mahdi and all that stuff. So here we got, this wouldn't be totally unusual, I guess. I want to tell you something about Moses. When he struck the rock in the desert and it brought forth water, he thought, what a good opportunity to have a bath. So Moses removed his clothes, put them aside on the rock, entered the water. When he got out and wanted to dress, his clothes had vanished. A Palestinian had stolen them. The Palestinian representative of the UN jumped up furiously and shouted, what are you talking about? Palestinians weren't even there. The Israeli representative smiled and said, and now that we have made that clear, I'd like to begin my speech. And now that I've made that clear, I'll begin my sermon. I don't know if it happened, but kind of interesting anyway. With all over there, I'd have to say that's what I would call a PSN. Prophetically significant news. There's a lot of that going on these days. But I won't be preaching about that today. That'll be for some other time. What do the Sabbath, Feast of Tabernacles, and the city of Jerusalem all have in common? Answer? That most elusive P word, peace. The Sabbath is a day of peace. It pictures and prefigures, along with the Feast of Tabernacles, a very special period of 1,000 years that we're all well aware of. 1,000 years of peace, we call the millennium, the world tomorrow. And Jerusalem, the capital to be of that 10th-century exhibition of peace on earth, in Hebrew, is translated City of Peace. The center and symbol of God's government for all eternity. How important is peace to God? That His special day, His sign of identity, the carnation in the lapel, along with loving our brothers, and that's an interesting subject in itself. His special day, His signature day of identity, is a day about peace. That His last and crowning festival of the year is all about peace. Peace through His Christ-led government for 1,000 years portrayed symbolically on the Feast of Tabernacles. And then as a conclusion, allowing us to step through the portal of eternity on the last great day with His spiritual family of peace forever. And finally, that the Father Himself comes down to earth for the first time to dwell with His newly minted family in His shiny new capital, whose name represents His natural way, City of Peace, where love and faith and wisdom dwell and ensure that peace is maintained for eternity. I'd say peace is pretty. No, I'd say extremely important to God in all its facets. But how do we get there? As we just talked about Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama, in an intractable situation in the Mideast where you have neighbors, or at least one neighbor, who will not acknowledge the existence and represent an existential threat along with their neighbors, some 250 to 300 million of them against 7 million. Now that's pretty good odds. Not a lot of peace around these days. So how do we get there? Especially as we watch peace literally evaporate before our eyes on the world scene, across North Africa and in the Mideast. Of course, we know that is PSN as well. Prophetically significant news. As we await Mr. Ahmadinejad's theocratic caliphate, known as the King of the South. It's important. That's very important. So as we watch those things take place before our eyes, we realize we're in a period that we've been talking about for decades, and it's happening right before our eyes. as we watch peace evaporate. Like I said, on the world scene, in our nation, they say we've never been as divided in this country as we are now since the days of the Civil War. And of course, very sadly, we were for a time, for about 3 years, in our own spiritual sanctuary, the church. The small showcase spiritual nation we've been called and privileged to participate in. We're going through spiritual boot camp now, and it's tough at times, as all such places of training are. Ask any, how many here have been through boot camp, been in the military? Well, we've got a couple. Yeah, you know what it's like. A lot of fun, isn't it? But I've ever talked to says they'd rather have a beating or move. I'd rather have a beating than move. A house, that is. The spiritual boot camp to prepare us for this special ambassadorship, that preparation recognizes that the development of humility is the critical first step as we think about peace this afternoon. And then our spiritual DI, our drill instructor, if you will, lets us practice a principle that is so vital for peace, learning how to lose. But it's a special type of losing. It's becoming a loser for God. Now the stage is set for some very high God-level activity. Some of the highest man can achieve, I believe, peacemaking. The specific activity I'm referring to is a term we came to use quite often. I was down at Big Sandy over four decades. That's hard to believe. They're having a reunion here this summer. I'm not going to be able to make it, but it's been fun watching all the names come up. A gentleman is putting this together, and it was the founding class that started about 1964. And I got in at the tail end of that starting period, 68. But I can remember those years, and it's interesting. There's a website, and there's a lot of reminiscing going on by the old grads, all of it positive about what a good time it was. And it was. Big Sandy in 68, 69, 70 was a good place to be. It's those in Pasadena, I don't know if everybody's from Pasadena here at that time. They used to call it the country club, and I guess I couldn't disagree. We had a ranch, ride horses, a golf course, all the athletic facilities you wanted, tucked out in the country. It was a pretty little place. So anyway, there was a term that came to use quite often at Ambassador Big Sandy back in the late 60s. We called it heaping coals. And most of the guys that were using it were only half converted, if even that, me being one of them. I ended up getting baptized down there. I don't know how much progress made since, but some of the guys I hung out with are going to be at that reunion. We used to talk about heaping coals. And it's closely related to Matthew 5, 43, 48. One of the first things Christ talked about, he laid out a gauntlet before his disciples and all mankind that would follow thereafter. And he said, basically, I'm going to ask you to do something that heretofore only gods have done. And so he lays out this gauntlet in Matthew 5, 43 through 48, maybe the most difficult and spiritually challenging of all Christian activity, learning to love our enemies. Even the thought of it, trying to process it, is difficult at best. Let's discover the secret of this strange-sounding metaphor, heaping coals, as we graduate to becoming mature sons and daughters of our spiritual Father, as peacemakers of the family of God. After all, what is the signature organization on the planet today, quote-unquote? The one we talked about earlier, the UN. It was put together for what? To keep peace. Not done a very good job. We know that. Let's go to Romans chapter 12. I'll be reading from the New International Version this afternoon. Romans 12. Romans is a powerful book, maybe the most powerful single book in the Bible, as it captures the essence of the plan of God, really, from its inception all the way through to its completion. And through the powerful pen and mind of the Apostle Paul, God caused to be recorded in one relatively short letter. Now, long for the Bible, but when you realize what's in there, all the elements of his plan and insight into his very mind and how he works, you realize a great work was done. Some say the book of Romans is the most elegant letter ever written by the hand of man. I wouldn't disagree with that. Anyway, to Romans 12, well into the program, towards the end of the program. And we see some very interesting things. Scott Stewart starts off with living sacrifices, a whole subject in and of itself. We're going to pick up Paul's thoughts here in verse 17. And he's thinking back maybe about Matthew 5. But he says, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. If it is possible, as far as depends upon you, live at peace with everyone. And do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, in contrast, you as a Christian with the Spirit of God coursing through your spiritual veins, think this way. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you shall heap burning coals on his head. When you first read that, without any background or understanding of the context, is probably the strangest sounding thing you've ever read. He asks you to take this highest form of Christian activity, showing love to an enemy. There is none higher. There is none more difficult. There's none that asks for more. In spiritual Matthew 5:48 maturity, than this request right here. And yet, on the surface, it is bizarre. But this is the New Testament. And Paul didn't pull this one out of the air. He's quoting Solomon. Turn over to the book of Proverbs. Because he didn't quote the whole thing, most of it, but he left out one very important element that I think Paul gets to later on. Chapter 25 and verse 21. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, water to drink. In so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. 1,000 years before Solomon penned this proverb, and he said that this activity is strange, whatever it means, is blessed activity of a very high level, and that you would be indeed blessed if you do so. What is this strange sounding tradition from a culture 3,000 years in the past? According to the commentaries, and there are several possible renderings, like most difficult areas of Scripture in the Bible, there are several renderings and meanings. But the context of both Proverbs 25 and Romans 12 leave us with one inescapable conclusion. It is a good and noble act that will usually lead to peace with an enemy and a reward for the heaper. Now you can see why at Big Sandy a bunch of Carl guys went around and said, let's heap some coals. We want to be blessed. We knew it was important and without understanding really what we were talking about. At least, you know, to any depth. In Solomon's time, we know that fire was critical for both heat and light in all those ancient societies. I mean, it wasn't an easy thing. They didn't walk around with a Bic lighter, you know. I don't even know if they knew yet, you know, how to use the bow. And, you know, for Boy Scouts, we used to have to do that. We used a bow and a leather and, you know, a stick with a little tinder. Or, you know, use a flint and steel, those types of things. Maybe they did. They had to get it someplace. But anyway, they didn't have a Bic lighter. It wasn't easy to come by. So this gift of coals, already prepared and ready to go, was a high-level gift, a valuable gift. If your fire went out, you need some help. And as we know from our study of the Bible and around Christmas time, it got a little nippy in Palestine. So nippy that these little critters that go around with wool coats this thick were brought in from the highlands. It's like cold down there, and I've been down there in the summertime. I know it gets hot, but it got cool at night because it's a desert. Anybody's ever been in a desert, and it's all relative. You get used to 95, 98 degree temperatures during the day. It cools down to, you know, even the 60s. Pretty cool. So anyway, it's nice to have some coals around. And once again, didn't have central electrical heat or gas or oil or any of those things at that time either. Coals were pretty valuable. So, as far as we can tell from this metaphor, it was a valuable gift that was critical to life. In other words, light as well as heat. Could be used in crafting processes, oftentimes was, for forming and shaping of metals. And, you know, firing ceramics, those types of things. So I think a pretty good case can be made that obviously Solomon, Paul felt it was too. Pretty important. So providing anybody, much less an enemy, and that's the contrast that Paul's getting at here, and so Solomon, with such a valuable commodity and service, would be seen as the epitome of a fine gift and concern, wouldn't it not? I mean, you know, I think it would be. You could also extend the metaphor to the refining process of melting down one's animosity that would be coming from an enemy, even furthering the possibility of turning him eventually into a friend, somebody who's golden or of silver, great, precious. Because there is nothing in life more precious than a friend. That's what Christ says. Remember, we just read it at Passover. He says, I no longer call you servants. I call you friends. The Creator of the universe says the ultimate level you will attain to in the universe is a friend of God. And therefore, any friendship you have on the planet now is a type of the relationship the Father and Christ have had back ever in eternity. And is how they've been able to live at peace during that time, are now trying to teach us how to live at peace. Doesn't mean, and I, you know, this is speculation, I can't believe the Father in Christ, as they were creating the incalculable number of permutations and combinations of systems throughout the earth. You go down, you know, they're discovering things all the time at the atomic and subatomic level about how this world is created. And all those systems that work like a fine Swiss watch. As we look at all those things, I can't believe there was never a difference of opinion. Maybe even a disagreement. Kind of interesting. God says, be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath.
They probably never got angry. I don't know. We'll have to ask them. But they never sinned. And we're in peace eternally as far as we know. And that's our job. That's where we're headed. Friends who live at peace for eternity go in the other direction. That's what the holy days are all about. They're showing us how to do that. That's why it's so important to God. It's right up the top after love, after God, and the interesting in the fruit of the Spirit. You ever notice? Ever analyze the fruit of the Spirit? Incredible complexity of nature and character and personality involved in those characters. God says, and there is an order to them. An order. Starts with love, which is God's nature, what He is. But then He says that nature lives in two ways. Love sets up the ability to have joy and peace. Peace of mind and joy for the heart. The two functional systems that war against each other in the creative beings that God has made and called His children, who are made in His image and likeness. And so He says, if you are love, you can have peace of mind and love or joy of heart, so you can enjoy this life with Me for the rest of eternity. And as you work your way down those other fruit of the Spirit, it's a fascinating exercise to understand the mind of God. And at the bottom, He says, of all things, He says, remember, as you work your way down through these, always remember balance. Some call it temperance, some call it, you know, other things. And it's interesting, in Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, don't be overmuch righteous. You end up like a Pharisee. Anyway, that's a little... We do that. And you probably notice ministers do that sometimes. We get up here and we're talking about one subject, and all of a sudden, whoosh. I've given this sermon, well, it's about the third time now. I end up giving it about six times. We travel around the territories. We help out the other neighbors. They never come out the same. I never know what I'm going to say when I come up here. I got notes, but, you know. You want to split? Maybe it's that time. Split time. Split sermon. Anyway. I didn't notice, Dave. Did you drink out of one of these? I'm ambidextrous. I can drink with either hand, so you just tell me which one you drank with. You didn't. Okay. I'll put my finger in the other one, make sure. It's actually not that hot. I'm just talking too much. It's not an easy thing to do in life at any stage. Thus the preparation I mentioned at the beginning, whose foundation I laid down in my last two sermons. This is actually the third of a trilogy. I gave the first in St. Paul at a combined services back at the end of January, I recall. It's called The Power of Humility. There was one in between called Becoming a Loser for God. And as I go along, I'll kind of bring you up to speed. It sets the stage for this highest level of Christian activity, peacemaking 101. Actually, it's probably should be 501 or whatever graduate level classes are, you know, numbered these days, but it's probably some of the highest of all. Let's check the context of our coal heaping. It's always a good idea. Back to Romans chapter 12. Let's go back to verse 14. Romans 12, verse 14. These were the scriptures leading up to the ones I read earlier. It said, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony. Another way of saying peace, right? Peace and harmony. They go kind of like love and marriage, like a horse and carriage. Peace and harmony, they kind of go together. With one another, do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. kind of repeating the first. And then it goes on to what he's talking about, eventually heaping coals. Note it's similar in context to verses 17 through 20. Kind of an intro summary statement, you might say. Verse 15, it says, it shows the other side of emotional activity in life, the full human range here, as you look at it. And in verse 16, it says, here's the setup for heaping coals. To live in harmony or peace, do not be proud or conceited. That is, humble yourself. Isn't that the opposite? A proud, conceited individual is to humble yourself. You might say that's our ultimate attitude adjustment. That's what God's working on. Why the first thing we do in the year? Even before we take the bread and the wine. Foot washing. And we talk about having a foot washing service, you know, throughout the year. And then we come to understand a couple years ago that what Christ did was something that nobody did. We used to think the servants washed feet, but from what we understand, and maybe under some circumstances they did, but what we found out was the servants brought the water, and the traveler washed his own feet. I don't know if you remember that. That was a couple years ago. I think Mr. Nisko had done some research on that, a very fine sermon, and it gave us, expanded our minds as far as how God's work together and what they're really like when it comes to this humility business. Because the creator of the universe with an IQ of a squillion, the power to match on us little creepy crawly things down here, ours children, but with lots to learn, came down and did something no other human being normally does. And it's the lowest. That the servants weren't even required to wash the feet of the travelers. What does that say about God? You know, the Father and Christ and how they've lived back ever in eternity. They're willing to do that. You know, and that was the first thing Christ did to get the program started. He says, you go back to this starting point. Anytime you get in trouble, go back there. Start there with the foot washing. And just think about me. I'm the creator. I've got everything. I'm all-knowing, all-powerful, all-present, all the rest. I'm willing to do that. So that's where it all starts. Then he says, because of that attitude, he was willing to do what? Associate with people of low position. Now, what is that? You think about society out there and how conscious, social and status conscious people are with clothes and money and finance and things. And of course, we got a nation of a billion plus who have a caste system and they don't dare even touch one another. I think there are 5 levels of caste in India. And de facto caste wherever you go. Christ said, there is no caste system in my family. And so he came down and not only washed feet, but then associated with the low in society, losing something. Reputation. He wasn't concerned about his image and how he looked to the upper class, the middle class. He hung out with the drunkards, the wine, what do you call them? The gluttons and the wine bibbers. Down at the local pub. Telling jokes. Clean ones. Having laughs. Associating with the men he worked with because he was a carpenter. In those days, carpenters were like contractors today. Except they didn't have the heavy equipment. He was the heavy equipment. That's why you read Bruce Barton's Man Nobody Knows. And it talks about as he took up the whip in the temple. In the summertime in Jerusalem, it can be 95. I've been there and worked there on the dig. And the sleeve of his short sleeve tunic slid up on a browned arm that showed an arm that looked like Charlie Atlas. Because he worked hard and lifted heavy things called rocks and moved them to make foundations for homes. That's what carpenters did. It wasn't all, now it's nail guns, right? You don't get a lot of, well, you might have a strong finger, you know. Anyway. So as that sleeve slid back to expose that well-tanned and wonderfully developed right arm, or maybe he was left-handed. I don't know. It doesn't say whether he's left or right. I never thought about that. He's very creative. He's a creator. A lot of creative people are left-handed. You know how that one goes. Right people use their left mind, left side of their brain. That means only left-handed people are in the right mind. So anyway, when those Pharisees, who probably were milky white from pushing pencils and not seeing the sun too often because of those garments they wore, saw that arm and that whip, they got their attention. So he wasn't too worried about being a loser in society because he was the ultimate winner. And he wanted to show mankind how they could be winners. He knew a secret, and we know a secret. Our 30 to 40 to 50,000 brothers and sisters around the world in the various organizations we call sisters in our own rules of association, sister churches, understand a priceless secret about all this. That those lowly folks in the fifth caste in India and everybody like it that walks the societies of the rest of the world, and they're there, are all made in the image and likeness of God and are all potential brothers and have the same potential as you and I, and someday may be our bosses in the kingdom of God. Who knows? Who knows how that's going to work out? They could be angels unawares. Some cases. That's a big secret. It's a powerful secret. And it shapes behavior. Because you know that that human being you're looking at isn't a low person. That's God. In a chrysalis, as Mr. Armstrong used to say. And that's the secret foundation for making peace with all human beings. It starts with those two items. A humble attitude that's willing to lose a lot of things that are totally unimportant with God and therefore should be unimportant to us. It's a big secret. That's what real winners are all about. And we start to see, as we look at Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, that memory scripture that says, our thoughts are not God's thoughts, and our ways and actions and deeds are not God's. Well, this starts to take it a step further. It says, our eyes as well. As we start to see things differently, they're only in a temporary lull. Now, this sets the stage for peacemaking, as I mentioned. Maybe the toughest assignment of all. By becoming humble and willing to lose, we are now ready to make peace with one proviso. Verse 18 of Romans. We read over it. Chapter 12. If it is possible, as far as depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Because you see, it is a two-way street, ultimately, or process. Because even God Almighty Himself cannot always accomplish it, as we've seen with Satan and the demons. We don't know in the future who all is going to be on the other side of that ledger, part of the dark force, dark side. Hopefully not many. Ideally none, but it doesn't sound like that. So here are given the very best tools in the universe, as we've seen used by Jesus Christ Himself, who was the humblest of all, was willing to be a loser, by working with the low in society primarily. You probably remember that. He came to heal the sick, not the whole, not quench a smoking flax or a bent reed would he break. Very interesting poetic language. Basically says he wouldn't heap anything more. He wouldn't pile on, as we say in football, on those that are already down. So how does it work? How does this all work as we get now? We've kind of done, laid the preparation for peacemaking 101, heaping coals. How does it work? Well, it's kind of ABC 1, 2, 3. The first two steps we talked about, obviously, humility and willingness to lose. Then all you have to do is call on Oli to negotiate. You didn't know Oli was a great negotiator, did you? Well, you're going to hear about his negotiating skills. One day during the big recession that we've got on now, sounds like it's going to be a double dip. Some feel we're already in a depression. United States is very close to losing its AAA Moody bond rating. Just read on Drudge last night, somebody mentioned it, we were talking to somebody, and mentioned in Drudge last night, the Chinese just sold off 97% of their T-bills. That's short-term government bonds that, a year or less, basically, called T-bills, or three classes. Anyway, that's the shortest term. 97%. Anyway, it's a tough time. So anyway, Oli goes into his boss. And he says, I've been working here for two decades. I says, I'm a very loyal employee. He says, I've worked very hard. And he says, I've done some good work too. He says, I need to raise. And he says, I got four companies after me. Well, the boss thought, you know, I don't need a brain drain now. Oli's been a good employee. So he thought about it for a few minutes. He says, okay, Oli. He says, I'll tell you what. Best I can do during this time is I'll give you 10% in another week's vacation. He says, how's that? Well, he says, oh, that's wonderful. He says, that's wonderful. So Oli is heading out the door, and the boss says, Oli, he says, by the way, he says, who are the four companies that are after you? He says, oh, he says, the Water Country Electric Company, the gas company, and the mortgage company. So anyway, you never need any negotiation, you know where to go. And a lot of pressure, that boy. Okay, we're talking about 1, 2, 3 step as we get into. We'd mentioned humility in all circumstances prepares the spiritual soil for a bountiful harvest. How? By recognizing who we really are. We 98 Sixers, who the rest of the world really are as well, as we just mentioned, all potential sons of God. And friends too, potentially. You ever think about the fact we've got the rest of eternity, we've got all the time in the world, and some estimate 100 billion people since Adam to roughly around now. It's going to be a long time to get to know all those folks, and everyone can become a very good friend. That's God's goal. Everyone with a little difference of personality and outlook and talent mix or blueprint. It'd be fascinating. Have as much time as we need. All made in God's image and likeness. But now, as we know, with a Jeremiah 17:9, Isaiah 64:8, you know, heart that is desperately wicked above all things, who can know it? Righteous acts as filthy rags. That's the base, you know, kind of like the Marines. We talked about the drill sergeant. What do they say when you go in the military? We're going to tear you down and build you up. God's army is no different. So he starts with that. How many people know that? Jeremiah 17, Isaiah 64, base, and it is base, nature of man. Humanism dominates. We're living in a humanistic world. So, we know that. We assume or judge no one. That's spiritual maturity. We come to understand when it comes to their current or ultimate spiritual status. Doesn't mean we don't make judgments in certain situations. You know, 1 Corinthians 6 is a chapter all about judging. And learning how to do it at the church level. If you're going to be a king and priest in the world tomorrow, over cities and nations, you've got to learn how to do some judging, some evaluating. Like, any good leader, CEO, has to learn to do, manager. That's where we're going to be. That's what a king priest is all about. You got to manage and teach. So anyway, we're not to judge, though, as far as spiritual status, if you know that. We've got to be careful. We say things at times, and I hear things. Things come back. For those of you who read Mr. Kubik's, it's a ministerial letter, but I don't. That's certainly to be shared. He did some exit interviews, if you will, with some people that left United and found out some very interesting things. And you go, I won't go into detail on it, but the point being that we've all got a long ways to go in the ministry. And I've stood up at this pulpit and apologized on behalf of the ministry. We didn't do a very good job the last 3 years. And God, for some reason, is putting the ministry through the paces because I think He realizes there's some work to do there. The members, have been through it too, and you unfortunately get dragged into it. But a lot of very subtle and difficult things we're learning right now. And Mr. Kubik points out some of them. Anyway, they have to do with humility and concern and other basic things, things that were pointed out earlier. Humility puts us in a mental, emotional position, a spiritual position to be willing to lose. We kind of implied that, talked about it. Our responsibility and duty in many areas of life, even when we're right. Hardest thing in the world to do is when you are right and you know you're right, to back off. But sometimes spiritual maturity asks you to do that if you want to be a peacemaker. As Paul points out in the next chapter, we just finished, two chapters over, chapter 14. As we kind of round up the end of this powerful book that explains how to be God from beginning to end, because that manifestation starts in this first chapter when he gets at the mind of man and works his way through. By the time you get to 14, Paul's saying, look it. You've grown up and matured as a Christian to the point where you should be able to lose if you have a weak brother. And you're right, and you know you're right. But you've got to be willing sometimes to exercise wisdom and say, now is not the time. And so he goes in that chapter, I'm not going into it, but it's a great chapter to read during the Passover season, right along with all the others. So what Paul is telling us there, winning is not always the most important thing. Maybe it's more important for that other person to win, who is weak in the faith and has to learn and grow up and develop the spiritual muscle we call character. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. And do it without getting a big spiritual head. Philippians 2:3, esteem others better than yourself. That's right up there. Galatians 6:1, you see a brother with a problem, gently, gently restore him. No big head. And we can do this because we know God is behind us, backing us all the way, just as He did Christ. So step 3 then. After humility and willingness to lose, kind of going back in a little bit, to peace and peacemaking. We can see, I think, how proud, conceited people can cause disharmony and destroy peace, as can disputes and sinners. We see in, you read 1 Corinthians 6, it talks about the problems they were having in the Corinthian church. They had all kinds of problems in that church. But one of them, they were going to court against each other over. It says disputes. It says they weren't even sins, as far as we can understand from the context, of that chapter. But They were having problems, human relations problems. They weren't at peace in that church at all. And they were even going to court to settle things. And he says, you've already lost. It's a whole other sermon by itself. And the second sermon, I probably won't be giving here, but I go into that and show that you needed to be willing to lose those guys that were going to court, because that's what Paul said. You've already lost. If the whole purpose of being here is to become like God, and this is a training exercise, this is boot camp, you just failed. Go do it again. I'm going to give you another chance because you missed the point of what you're trying to learn here. And there are a lot of those exercises in life where you get out in front of yourself and you're trying to do something, you forget, well, I'm here. That isn't a bad bumper sticker. What would Christ do? I ought to be right here. And most of the time he was willing to lose in a very humble way. Paul starts this out, like I mentioned, with a caveat in Romans 12:18. He says, if it is possible, we do know that things are conditional. People like Neville Chamberlain learned that the hard way during before World War II when he went over to Hitler and came back and said, peace in our time. Some people you can't negotiate with. Right now, Mr. Netanyahu is not able to negotiate with the Palestinians. As long as you have a terrorist organization that is an existential threat, doesn't believe in there should be existence. I mean, duh. It is the height of naivety to think you can negotiate with such people. That's why God doesn't negotiate with Satan anymore. There was probably a time he worked with him and tried to help him. Those days are past. To understand peacemaking 101 as we head down the backstretch here, coal heaping, we must start with the fact that we live in two worlds and they operate by three, not two, but three different sets of rules. The first world, God's church, an imperfect extension of His kingdom here on earth, is under God's law first and man's law second. But it is under man's law. As the next chapter in sequence shows, it's interesting, after this heaping coals exercise, the next chapter is Romans 13, one of the most important chapters in the Bible to help Christians understand the relationship with the world in which they exist. And it is a third world. Kind of a middle world, for those of you who are Hobbit fans and Lord of the Rings and stuff. It is a middle world, as we'll see. So, as Paul and Peter make it abundantly clear, First Peter 2. We are Christians under man's law now, as long as it doesn't conflict or negate the higher court of law in the third heaven. We know that. You obey God rather than man, but you do obey God, or obey man, for everything thereafter. The second world is Satan's and man's world. And it has two sets of laws. First, you have man's law, we just described in Romans 13. We'll go there in a minute. And Satan's law, that of the criminal mind and animal. It wants no rules or rulers but self. We'll start from the reverse and work our way back up. Anarchy, Satan's program of no law, is in real life application a contradiction. For even the most ruthless and lawless of men have their own codes. Never noticed that? It was said during the early part of the 20th century in suburban Chicago, there's a town called Cicero. Never heard of Cicero, Chicago? Suburb just to the east or west of downtown. Had the least crime of any part of the greater metro area. Some say in the whole United States. You know why? It was the home of the mob. Organized crime. They're willing to go out and kill other people, steal, lie, cheat, whatever it took to build their empire. But internally, they wouldn't put up with it. Anybody watched the Godfather series, you know how that works. Wouldn't that be a wonderful life? You cross one of the dons and you get a contract out on you. And then every moment, waking, wake or sleeping, you never know when there's either going to be a horse head in your bed or you're going to be the horse head. Yeah. Anyway. So don't think that Sisera was a great place to live just because it had no crime. That wasn't the point. Join the mafia and you're going to live in a crimeless area. That'd be the worst form of all life, because that's Satan. That is a form of anarchy. Satan knows the best way to destroy men and their peace is to destroy God's law and corrupt the enforcement. And we're seeing that more and more all the time. You know, from this community of Bell, California, small suburb of L.A., where the chief of police, the mayor was making close to $1 million, and the chief of police was like $700,000 or something. I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable. The result of no enforcement and corruption is no deterrent to bad behavior. Solomon understood this, Ecclesiastes 8:11. You're familiar with that area, scripture? Let's go over there. Got to read a scripture now and then. Usually just reference them, but we'll read this one. It really tells you what's going on in the world of criminology. Simple answers. Powerful principles. We live in an age where Machiavelli has taken over. Principle's not important. It's means to the end thinking that people operate by. 8:11. When a sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, the hearts of children or people are filled with schemes to do wrong. There's no deterrent if it takes too long. You can tie courts up forever, interminably. As you look today, we got 80% of the world's lawyers looking for loopholes. You know, law, that's why now Congress is talking about getting rid of the loopholes. They keep trying, but a tremendous amount of inertia because of, you know, special interest groups and lobbyists, etc. It's tough. So is it any wonder crime is rampant in modern Israel? And God said it would be, that Israel would be worse than the Gentiles in the end time. We're starting to see that. It's interesting. I was just talking with somebody the other day, might have been my brother, one of my brothers, about the fact that how God chastises modern Israel. He says it'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, in that day in the resurrection than for Israel because of what they've known and then what they've done with it. So, no wonder there's no peace. Let's see where God's world and Satan's interface. Let's go to Romans 13. That was Satan's. Satan's law at that point, when you get into the criminal world and the criminal mind, there are no rules, there are no laws. Whatever it takes to get the job done, life, limb, etc., is no meaning. In the church, we know what we believe. But in between, there is a great mass. Thoreau called them the teeming, silent majority who live their lives of quiet desperation. Isn't that beautifully phrased? And that's so true. Live their lives, they go about their business of quiet desperation. So Romans 13. Like I mentioned, it's interesting. It follows right on the heels of coal heaping. Verse 1, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority, rebellion is as witchcraft. Remember that? Against authorities rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are no terror, etc. You've read this probably many times, and God commends. So this is God's system. It's the middle world that we maybe don't think about too often. It's not God's government per se. We are living that, trying to. But it is an authorized version for a very vital purpose. In verse 1, we see that without law and order, there would be anarchy, no law. Christians could not survive long in that environment. And we know there have been periods of great persecution down through the ages, but, you know, it wasn't every day, every week, every month, every year for long stretches. They were periods of terror. But then there were periods when they could live their lives. The Roman Empire was a pretty peaceful period for the most part. They called it Pax Romana. Roman peace. The Romans didn't want war. They wanted shekels, dinero, el buckles. Just stay peaceful, do your work, guys, talking to the provinces that were conquered, and pay us our tribute. That's all they wanted. So there were some redeeming qualities to the Roman Empire until you got bad leadership. Claudius, Nero, they were the first to really start the persecutions, but, you know, the Caesars, starting with Augustus and some of those, weren't too bad in some respects. So as a result, if you don't have this Romans 13 middle world between the Church of God practicing God's government, trying to learn how to live it, and Satan's world down here, the two extremes with which life is usually made, in between you've got this broad majority governed by Romans 13. Individuals not ready to be called yet, but haven't gone off the deep end and developed a criminal mind. They're willing to go along. Now it's getting tougher, it's getting worse, there are more problems with Romans 13 all the time, and as we see coming down to the very end, it'll be bad. 1 Timothy 3 talks about that. Or 2 Timothy 3, I think it is. So these rules are here so that we don't end up with a veritable jungle, survival of the fittest mentality and environment where spiritual criminals and thugs have sold their souls to a life of crime like Ahab. Remember King Ahab? It says he sold his soul. Kind of a Faustian contract. Faust, remember, sold his soul to the devil, Mephistopheles and the devil, and, you know, so he could do things. And there are all these plots and books over the years have done that. So, if you have that, it's very difficult in that environment. It's a state of micro-war, if I can put it that way. You know, kind of like Big Brother. Can you imagine trying to be a Christian in 1984? The book I'm talking about, the movie or the book, in that environment with Big Brother. And, of course, the communist world was like that. That's why it was an atheistic system. Very tough to be a Christian in those times under that system. So God has instituted Romans 13 and backed it up so that there is some semblance of peace and law and order so that His microcosm that we're living can exist. Be very difficult. And of course, he raised up in the end times, the last 200-300 years, nations blessed because of the blessings of Abraham, so that we could do this work. Really, the only time you could do a major work over the last 2,000 years, since the US and BC came onto the scene and became the world's policemen and enforced, in some semblance, Romans 13, and because we have our wonderful Constitution and I just love, the Declaration of Independence. And certainly the Magna Carta, which came before and which was based, common law and all the rest. It was God's way of starting so that He knew what His family, His church would need at this time and down through the last several hundred years. So, very, very important we understand that God has allowed societies to be civil enough, if I can put it that way, to keep God's plan going for 6,000 years with one major course correction. And that, of course, was the Noachian flood. And then he made a correction. He dialed down the longevity. He realized 1,000 years was too long to live. And so now it's about 100. You know, 70 to 80 to 100. But that's as Christ stated in Matthew 24:22. He said, no flesh would survive at the time of the end. As he allowed this thing to come up, as he allowed the dial, so to speak, Satan to turn up the heat on his, you know, on God's system, and we get farther and farther away from Romans 13, and certainly God's government, and more like Satan's all the time. And of course, at the end, right at the end, we see what happens. So in this middle world of Romans 13, reasonable pre-called men and women not submitting totally to Satan, we see some 6,000 years with periods of peace so that this work could survive and we could grow an environment and have a church like this today and have lives with, you know, incomes and opportunities to serve and grow. It'd be very difficult without it. Spiritual child raising is difficult enough without that. But what of God's spiritual family and its mandate to be a modern showcase, living at peace and love nation? I think we'd agree that over the last years, the church has struggled, over all the years, to a degree to achieve that third heaven state on earth. You can go back as far as you want. There have always been problems in God's church. Read the letters in Revelation. They, and we understand them, represent about 2,000 years worth of church history. There are problems in every one of them, some worse than others. As we read the book of Acts, the epistles, the second and third chapters of Revelation, we see the struggle down through the centuries from an aesthetic distance of time over broad periods of history, through the eyes of the apostles and the prophets, as they looked at and they tell us and read that story. We're not up close and personal, so we get that kind of a long view of history. But he do leave us a few examples. We see Barnabas and Paul going at it over young John Mark, the man who would write most of the New Testament. We see the 1 Corinthians Sixers and their legal disputes and the greater church-wide watershed divide between the Jews and the Gentiles in Acts 15. And the problems that that fraught. There wasn't a lot of peace at times. That would have been a period very much like our Civil War. And of course, Peter and Paul in Galatians 2. So there are a few examples God shows that it wasn't perfect. So the modern era upsets and crisis of the worldwide Church of God in the 70s, I lived through the 70s, many of you did, is not an easy period. I have many stories to tell, as I'm sure you do. The 90s, or the more recent battles of 1998 and 2010 within United, somehow should maybe not shock or greatly surprise us. But then I think we had all thought, with all that history behind us, we'd grown and learned. And yes, even spiritually matured enough to overcome such spiritually unimpressive activity. But then we thought the same of David and Peter too, didn't we? You look at David. Early, middle, late life, 40 years, man after God's own heart. Things far, far worse than anything that's happened in the last 3 years, not even close. Peter had his problems too, considering his rank, his position. And it wasn't just during the cock crowing period when he was just getting it. It was 10, 20, 30 years down the road. He reverted. Galatians 2 was not written 2 weeks after Christ was resurrected and went to heaven. 15, 20 years. So we're learning stuff, lots of stuff. Learning how to grow up, try to understand some of these things that are almost incomprehensible, considering how far along we should be with the average age in the church, 25, 30 years, more than that in some areas. But as my alumni basketball tournament t-shirt And I brought that when I gave my sermon on losing. Started out like this. Everybody knows what that means in this day and age. Losers. But I've got a t-shirt that I got. I still play a little basketball. I was on the alumni team. Let me play a couple minutes. I basically just kept the bench warm for the rest of them, younger guys. But it was mostly older guys. And that t-shirt had something very interesting on it. Something I've thought of for years. Because I like sports. I've been playing sports ever since I was a little guy. It said, basketball doesn't develop character. And haven't you all heard that sports develops character? All I have to do is watch, unfortunately and very sadly, the debacle that was the Los Angeles Lakers final against Oklahoma City. Against the Dallas Mavericks. It was a sad, sad sight for role models, quote unquote. Anyway, this t-shirt says, basketball doesn't develop character. It exposes it. And we're seeing that in spades in the NBA this year. And so is true with life as we play the game of life. We get exposed. We just got exposed. It's all right. That chapter's not written. And there are 200 carve-offs from the Worldwide Church of God that keep the Sabbath and holy days. From what I understand, it's hard to believe, in the last 15, 16 years, 200. A lot of them are small. According to our own documents, they're brothers and sisters. And we're to treat them as such. And maybe there's something to be learned in all this, where God has allowed this spiritual balkanization. Gave a sermon on that several years ago, trying to understand why there were so many factions. Why God allowed spiritual balkanization. You know what I mean by that? When God allowed Yugoslavia to start to come apart. That was called the Balkans area, and they came apart. One nation, now we end up with about 7 or 8 different little nations. Had a member down in the Mankato church come to me about 3 months ago, we were down there. And he said, you know, when things were really tough, he said, we're going to keep dividing until there are only 2 left. And I said, why stop there? I don't know if he's referring to the 2 witnesses or what, but the point is our human nature not naturally play the team game, the unified game, the peace game. A good team is made up of individuals who don't care who takes the shot or hits the home run or catches the touchdown. And that's what God is building here, a team that doesn't care who leads, who gets the glory. And those teams are the ones that do the best, usually. So a lot of exposure going on right now, including just how subtle and devious and brilliant our spiritual adversary really is. Sometimes you get tired of it. I think we all got fatigued the last few years. But God says He'll give us a wide place in Psalms, a place to rest if we don't give up. Many times throughout the New Testament, God admonishes, encourages us to overcome and endure to the end. I think we all feel, you're starting to hear it more from Beyond Today. They've had some wonderful pieces lately. I think they're making a point that we realize we're in the last decades. I don't think there's any doubt about it. It's a time to endure and hang on and learn how to find and make peace at all levels. Back to Romans 12 as we close. Heaping coals, verse 20. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In so doing, you'll be heaping burning coals. Paul tells us as well as the old master of wisdom Solomon, that if we challenge ourselves to think and say and do this towards our enemies, we will indeed overcome evil. Verse 21. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That this activity, this highest level spiritual activity of heaping coals, will help us fight evil in and of itself, and is a powerful antidote for it as we see the world becoming evil around us every day to a depth none of us probably could have conceived 20, 30 years ago. And we will be rewarded, as Solomon said. And where do our Galatians 6 brothers fit in? Those that have made mistakes, and we who have made mistakes, some sins, maybe some not. They're certainly not sinners by trade. It's a tough time we find ourselves in, and it will get even tougher as the days wear on. But we must never weary or give up of doing good. And I submit this, at the top of the good list is peace and peacemaking, the ultimate state of God's family for the rest of eternity. And if heaping coals works on our enemies, that is the uncalled, the unconverted, Gentile-minded, yes, all potential brothers in Christ, but not quite ready yet, then how much more should it work on our very own spiritual brothers and sisters? I think we all need to think very, very hard and very, very long on that one. As we keep the olive branch forever very close to our hearts. May we become expert coal heapers in our quest for eternal peace. And as Psalm 34:14 says, and we sing that wonderful hymn, seek peace and pursue it earnestly.